Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Paul Harris was born in Sacramento, California. He studied at UC Davis and worked as an assistant deputy probation officer. In 1977, a 21-year-old Paul Harris made a trip to New Orleans, which is America's most soulful city. He visited the French Quarter, enjoyed the food and live jazz. 28 years later, in August of 2005, he made another trip to New Orleans, and he was caught in a vicious storm, Hurricane Katrina. He became trapped for several days as a tourist inside the Superdome with 20,000 other helpless people. His 2008 memoir was the first one written about what it was like inside the Louisiana Superdome during Hurricane Katrina. He observed human behavior at its best and at its worst. On this 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, let's listen again to my 2010 interview with Paul Harris about his book, Diary from the Dome, Reflections on Fear and Privilege During Katrina. And now here's Paul Harris.
Sunday morning was the mandatory evacuation by Mayor Nagin. 10 a.m., I was watching the Weather Channel. It came on. The second he issued the mandatory evacuation, I caught a cab to Amtrak Greyhound. It's a combined station. And the cabbie said, it looks like they're closed. And I said, no way. He let me out. And so I got out, and sure enough, they were closed. I later learned that with the storm coming on Monday morning, the airport, Greyhound, and Amtrak had all closed Saturday night. So many of us couldn't get out. I thought of hitchhiking, but then I knew the worst place to be was on the freeway with a hurricane coming. So I knew special needs people could go over to the Superdome. That's what I did. I was one of the first person inside.
Yeah, because when you went, this was a vacation. You're planning on staying, what, 10 days?
Right.
So you had your reservations. And in fact, the first hotel kicked you out and said, sorry, you have to go find someplace else. So you found another place and they said, well, sorry.
Correct.
You have to find another place. And so you then, since the Superdome was near the Greyhound terminal and the Amtrak terminal, you just walked over there.
Right.
And like you say, you were one of the 400 sounds like a lot of people, but it's nothing compared to how many people ended up there. So you were really one of the early ones to arrive there.
Yeah, I was there at noon on Sunday. That's when they were supposed to let people in. They didn't let people in until about 2 p.m. They did a thorough frisking of everybody. They had an amnesty barrel. They announced if you have any drugs, weapons, alcohol, please deposit it in there. And I used to be a probation officer, so we would in juvenile hall do thorough frisking, and it was almost that thorough. I had to show a prescription for my Motrin in there, open up my suitcase. So while I know some things did get through, it was not what the media made it out to.
Well, now you say they, you're talking about the National Guard.
The National Guard did a fantastic job of inspecting us. They were way overwhelmed with the number of people. I would say they were
understaffed.
Maybe 400 of them for 15,000 people the first night, and it grew up to maybe 20, 25,000 people after several days.
Well, I was impressed with the way one of the guardsmen handled the situation, that with that many people and so few of the National Guardsmen, there was no way they could really enforce the rules they would like to have. And so one of them, one of the rules was you weren't supposed to smoke in the building. Mm-hmm. And he was very tactful. And do you remember what he said?
Yeah.
I remember. Yeah, go ahead.
At first, people, after the lights had gone out, we had a little generator power. People were going in the bathroom, smoking cigarettes. And he was telling people, you cannot do that. And then eventually he went in there and said, you know, there's people, medical patients here on respirators, and you're killing them by smoking inside this building.
He was saying that, you know, I can't keep you from smoking. I can't stop you from smoking. But just consider the effect that you're having on these people who are in really bad condition, people who have asthma. Because there were a lot of people there who had been taken there because they had bad health.
Right.
So you're in there with thousands of these people. And were there pets allowed in there?
There were not pets inside the Superdome, but a couple days later when they let us go out on the outside forum, people who had been evacuated from their homes, I would say I saw maybe 10 dogs and a few cats, a couple of birds, that kind of thing.
Well, I asked because the kind of emergencies that we have here in the North State are not hurricanes, but fire is a very has been a problem. And I always hope that, for example, older people that maybe their little dog is their closest friend. And I'm always so touched when a shelter is able to let that little dog stay with the person. And I never heard what was the case at the Dome, whether they did allow people to take pets in with them or not. And so it wasn't really, they weren't an obvious.
No. I don't think they did, because I don't think FEMA even allowed, they've since changed their rules for you to evacuate with your animal. Now you can. So it wasn't just till, it was later on when there were private citizens rescuing people off rooftops, bringing them to the Superdome, that they had their pets with them. And but again, those were all outside.
So you also mentioned that they had meals, MREs, the military kinds of meals, meals ready to eat, and that the first time you got in, everything was very orderly, and about 45 minutes you had your meal, and you didn't know how to heat it up. I mean, you didn't have matches with you. So I was interested in, oh, there's a way to heat that up.
Yeah, not being from a military family, I didn't know. There was a woman behind me, and she's very sweet, and showed me that you take this one pouch and you add a little bit of water to it and it automatically heats it up. You put your entrees, you know, whether it's roast beef, whatever, mashed potatoes on top of that, and it will heat it. I mean, it's enough that it'll burn you. And I thought that was fascinating. So then the locals who I had made friends with, I was showing them how to do it. So, but everybody learned that. And there was about 10 different varieties of MREs. We were thankful for that. And I was thankful that my tax dollars were going to a very good cause.
Yeah, and even as a vegetarian, that surprised me that they had vegetarian MREs.
Yeah, they did. They had, I think, two varieties.
And what people were very considerate of you and would pass you their vegetarian meal.
Right.
Thought that was nice. So you get in the first meal line and you get there about 45 minutes. Everything's nice and orderly. And the next meal line took longer because more and more people were pouring in. And there comes a point where you mentioned that you lost power. There was no power in the Superdome, but then the generators went on. So you lost electricity, the generators come on, but they don't have the power to air condition the building.
Right.
So there you are, and I don't know if people are familiar with the climate in New Orleans, but it can be very humid. So there you are in the humidity, in the heat. It's August, and no air condition, and very little light, actually, either.
This was, August 29th, probably 90 to 95 degrees, 90% humidity, not to mention the filth, the stink. After a day and a half, the electricity was gone. The toilets were overflowing. There was no running water left in the building. So it was, best I can describe, is like living in an outhouse for a week. It was just horrific. People were wearing MRE bags on their feet because their shoes were ruined. People were sleeping on urine-soaked cardboard. The generator power was enough to give you maybe 40% light, and that was it. The first meal, 45 minutes or so. After that, it went from an hour and a half in line up to 3 hours by the time we got out. Some people were cutting in line, but the National Guard was doing the best they could to stop that from happening.
You didn't tolerate that either.
No. I got really touchy when some people tried to cut in line. It almost erupted in a fight. But, you know, I needed to stand my ground, and we all needed to.
Yeah. Well, if the conditions are so horrible, why didn't you just leave?
Okay. A lot of us wanted to do that. The National Guard said we could not leave. They said there was martial law in the city. You would either be arrested or shot if you tried to leave. And that was the rule. And they stood guard with their M16s all around the perimeter outside the Superdome.
So you're really prisoners in there.
Yeah. And there was flooding outside the Superdome, between 2 and 3 feet of water. But there were thousands of people who would have loved to have left, even wading through the water.
I would think even after a while, he might decide, well, maybe being shot isn't so bad.
Exactly.
Maybe I'll take my chances. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. Well, as you say, you take walks around, because I would imagine it gets pretty boring. I mean, hour after hour, wondering, well, is something going to happen? Are we going to get released? Are people going to come rescue us? And so you stroll around, and you encounter a group of international group, people from all over. What countries are represented in this group that you met up with?
Okay. Most of them were staying at the youth hostel in New Orleans. There were Australians, New Zealands, Canadians, Haitians, French, German, Spanish,
I think it was a
Taiwanese.
Danish.
And a Danish guy approached me, and he could tell I looked like a tourist. And he said, "Do you want to join our group?" And I said, "Well, thank you, but I'm happy where I am with a couple of the locals." Also, I noticed most of their group was white. I didn't want to segregate. While I would guesstimate 15% of the population in the Superdome was white, I didn't want to make this little colony of white people. And so at first I said, no, I'm happy where I am. But I walked around a few more hours just to keep busy, get my exercise. I came back to my suitcase and I noticed something was gone from my suitcase, some like a brownie from my MRE. And so I thought the two guys who I was with had stolen it. And so I just said to them, hey, I ran into some people from California. I'm going to go join them in Section 113. It was all very cool. Days later, I discovered, though, that they hadn't taken a thing from me. But that saved me because I got to hook up with this group of about, had grown to 100 international visitors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you looked in your bag, you thought, oh, I put it in a different pocket
right.
than I thought I
exactly,
did. And,
exactly.
oh, I was having bad thoughts about these two guys
exactly.
and when they hadn't done a thing. But it did, like you say, that mistake on your part really is what saved you. And in the sense that when you did join up with this group, they were given special privileges that others won't. So why did this group get special treatment?
Okay. We spent Sunday, Monday, Tuesday night in the Superdome. On Wednesday, one of the Australians had been working with a sergeant in the National Guard and to arrange to try and get our group of 100 out. At first I didn't know why we were giving the special privileges. I thought maybe he really took a liking to some of the blonde Australian girls who were very cute, or he was scared for us, or what. Months later, I got in touch with him, and he said that he saw us as a naive group of tourists. He was concerned for our safety, and he liked our group, and he was driven by an angel to get us out.
Oh, yeah.
He was our guardian angel. And so they arranged groups of 10 of us at a time with armed guards to quietly get us out next door to
in
the
fact,
sports
they
arena.
They told you not to smile because that would give a clue because nobody else has anything to smile about.
Exactly.
And if they see this group of guys going out with a smile, they think, uh-oh, what's going on there? Because part of the problem was you didn't know anything. Nobody was giving you any information, so rumors are flying like crazy.
Exactly.
And that's all you had to go on. And you mentioned also, and it's in the subtitle of your book, Fear, because when the roof blew off of the Superdome, you didn't really know how safe were you in there?
Right, right. When there were two large panels, I would say 20 feet by 20 feet of the dome that blew off, water started to get in a little bit, but we knew that this dome was built to withstand 130-mile-an-hour winds at least, and if that happened, then what's going to stop it from all coming off, metal shards being sent down on our heads, decapitating us? Fear totally took over. We also heard rumors that another hurricane was coming in about 3 or 4 days. And I don't know why, but even though we were at that point way above sea level inside the higher levels of the dome, we pictured ourselves drowning. I mean, that is how powerful the fear was. And rumors were spreading. We believed all the rumors that you believed or heard on the media about the rapes and murders, even though they weren't happening.
Yeah. Well, I happen to have been an evacuee in a hurricane. And at the time, it was the most destructive, the biggest hurricane at that time. It's been since been surpassed. But we were told to evacuate. This happened in the coast of South Carolina. It was Hurricane Hugo. And citizens were told to evacuate. And we were just there for the year. We'd gone from California. We were there for the year. And so we were renting a house from a faculty member there at the College of Charleston. And as we were leaving, because there was only one direction to go, and that's inland, and there's an interstate that heads inland from Charleston to the capital, and the rumors that we were getting over the radio, because that's our only source of information, was that, well, they're going to change, instead of having the ingoing and outgoing lanes, they're going to make all lanes outgoing, because we were creeping along bumper to bumper. And so those are the rumors that we were getting. Also, our information was coming from the radio, and we would hear one announcer say, okay, we've been told we have to close down and evacuate. So we'd turn to another radio station, and then it would say, we've been told we have to shut down the station and leave. And so one by one, the radio stations were leaving. So we had no information either. One thing that I noticed that you did, you had the presence of mind to go to an ATM and get some cash. So you had some cash. And I think people don't realize that, well, just like right now, you can go get some gas. That's not a problem. You'll go to your ATM. But what about thousands of other people are all trying to do that at the same time? I think this is something that people don't take into account. And you mentioned toward the end of your book what you would suggest for a disaster kit. But there are also other things like that. I think if a hurricane is coming or fire or that to not wait until the last minute to fill your gas tank when everybody else is trying to do that or to go to the cash machine, the ATM machine, and get cash. So in some ways, you were in good shape. Mm-hmm. But there are a couple of things that you didn't do. Your friends, you have nice friends who said, Paul, take this cell phone with you on your vacation. And you're packing. I can just see you packing your clothes saying, it's a vacation. I don't want people calling me. And so the cell phone gets left in California when you go to New Orleans.
Right.
Would you change that decision?
Most definitely. I was always anti-cell phone. I was one of the last ones to get one, and finally my friends bought me one, and I looked at it, I charged it up, I left it in the room. And in fact, my friend Sarah, who was house-sitting, called my cell phone and heard it go off in the other room. She's like, oh. So after the hurricane, I was able to borrow a cell phone. Only about 10% of them were working, I would guesstimate. And I paid a woman $10 to use her cell phone. I called back to San Diego and said I was alive and everything was okay. Mm-hmm. Everything wasn't okay, but I told them that. So yes, I would bring a cell phone. I would also, instead of just packing any family, don't just pack for 48 hours or 72 hours. I would do a week's worth of provisions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here in earthquake country, fire country, keep the provisions in your car trunk, plus your office, plus your house. And be prepared for the worst, or expect the best, but be prepared for the worst. Also bring, if you have children, things that occupy them, whether it's their favorite book, a furry animal, same for your pets.
Well, and speaking of book, that was another interesting thing I thought, that you almost took Thoreau's Walden with you. Almost did, and then you changed your mind on that too.
Yeah, I had started to read it finally after all these years because I never read in school, and I loved it, I loved Thoreau. Instead, I took George Lakoff's Don't Think of an Elephant, which is a political treatise.
But you know what, too, as much as I love Thoreau and would love to reread it, I think I would be so I don't think I would be relaxed enough to sit and calmly read in the circumstances that you describe. Mm-hmm. Because on the one hand, it seems like it would be very boring. Mm-hmm. But on the other, there are so many things to be fearful of. And that paranoia would overcome, I think, my desire to to read a book, no matter how much I like the book.
Yeah. I wasn't very relaxed, but I did bring actually a journal, paper, and pen to write with, but I just wasn't in the mood.
It
was mainly walking around to keep occupied, keep my brain going. I played little jokes in my head, getting to talk to people, getting my exercise. I wasn't in a constant state of fear that I was going to die, but that was always in the back of my mind.
Well, I think one of the things that you and your group and others were wondering, why doesn't somebody come to get us out of here? Don't they know what's going on?
Yeah.
I'm sure there were all sorts of questions. And so you were complaining to each other, I'm sure, about the situation. What were the kind of things that you were wondering about?
Okay. We kept hearing the buses are coming, the buses are coming. And it turned out to be a lie. The buses weren't coming. Then we heard about the flooding. We thought, okay, you know, we know these people are in desperate straits. We're at least in a safe, semi-safe place. But then an hour would go by, and we hear more rumors. Nobody came through with their promises. And we really thought you out in America did not know we were even in there. All the communication we got was a couple of local radio stations where people were saying that people are stuck on rooftops. Please help me. I saw one reporter with a camera who was outside the Superdome. She was not allowed in. I saw one journalist inside. That was it. So we didn't have any information. communication is so very, very important in any type of disaster, and it just really wasn't there.
In fact, somebody told me that the one radio station was really not a radio station. It was an amateur guy who had rigged his own way of communicating, and he was the one that was providing information. So, you know, you listed some heroes, people who really did things that were wonderful and some not so wonderful. But I think you should include the radio station on
yes.
that list of heroes.
Oh, absolutely.
And not,
yeah.
I'm, of course, not prejudiced or partial, yeah. but I think radio stations, really. I know when the fires were raging through Northern California, people really relied on this station mm-hmm. for information. So I would say the radio is one of the heroes. There was another hero, and that was a bus driver.
Yes.
When you finally did get on a bus?
Yes. I got in the dome on Sunday, finally got bussed out from the Hyatt Regency on Friday to Dallas. But about 50 miles outside of New Orleans, our bus driver came on the speaker and said, "Does anybody have any medical training?" Da, 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 da. And he immediately did a U-turn off the next freeway exit, driving around cars. It was like a race car driver, and drove back to this bus that had overturned in front of us. And it was on fire, and he radioed again, "Anybody who has medical help, help me." And he ran off, pulled people out of the side of the bus that was on fire. Later found out that one person had died in the bus and about 17 injured. And that was just, we were so jazzed to finally be getting out of New Orleans, and this happened, and nobody spoke a word for hours. But yeah, that bus driver from Tennessee was a real hero.
Yeah,
I wrote to his company, but I don't
if it had an effect.
Got it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so he was another of the heroes. And then you mentioned that you were taken to, when you were smuggled out of the Superdome, first to a sports mm-hmm. arena, and then to the Hyatt, this place that you had described as lavish
yes.
when you were 21. That's where you got to stay. So the management of the Hyatt Regency is another hero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did a great job. They were still open. They didn't kick their guests out, but they probably had several hundred guests who were in there during Katrina. They moved to the other side of the building when the winds hit and were actually throwing furniture through the walls.
The wind was,
yeah. And they still had a receptionist in the lobby who would be answering questions. They did a great job as well.
Well, Oprah is a hero to a lot of people. She also came down and gave her support at one time. And you also say, of course, your friends back in California,
mm-hmm.
they were heroes because, for one thing, they tried to give you a cell phone to take with you that you happened to turn down. But you knew they were there supporting you and would have driven there to pick you up
exactly.
if they could. So they were another hero. And then you say the Postal Service.
Yeah, that's just an amusing thing. The morning, that Sunday morning before Katrina, the day before, I mailed off birthday cards. I mailed off party invitations, probably about 30 mailings. And up maybe 3 to 6 months later, about 50% of them made it through, even though that area was flooded. I don't know how they made it through. It was in 2 to 3 feet of water in a mailbox, but they made it through half of them, I'd say. So.
Yeah, well, this water that you mentioned, you had to wade through it in some of your when you were being transferred. And you were transferred like prisoners to mm-hmm. from one place. Of course, they couldn't let everybody else know that right. you were getting this privileged treatment. So after this experience, what did you learn?
Okay. I learned to look at myself and see how fear controls my life in any type of aspect. I learned to be a little bit more critical of the media, to not simply accept something because it's on Google or in the media or you hear it. I learned to rely upon myself more and be prepared for anything. I learned that compassion goes a long way, helping one another. I learned that probably 95% of people have good intentions. And in this particular situation, it was laid out that a lot of the people were evil in the Superdome, but it was just a very small percentage. Most people in there were families with children who were in the same situation as everyone else.
Thank you so much, Paul. My guest has been Paul Harris. His book is Diary from the Dome, Reflections on Fear and Privilege During Katrina. I'm Nancy Wigman. We're going to take a short break and come back with my next guest, Tom Epperson. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Tom Epperson was born in Arkansas, then moved to Los Angeles with his boyhood friend, Billy Bob Thornton, to pursue a career in show business. Among the movie scripts they wrote together was Jane Mansfield's Car. John Epperson has also written books, and his book, The Kind One, earned him a Best First Novel nomination. Today I'm going to ask Tom about his latest book, Baby Hawk, which is a novel in verse that takes place in the mountains and forests of Northern California. Tom Epperson, welcome.
Hey, Nancy. How's it going?
Well, it's going great because I really, as a reader, I like the fact that you wrote this in verse. I think it's very reader-friendly. But why did you write this story in verse?
That's a good question. I spent most of my career in Hollywood. I spent 40 years in Hollywood. But before that, I spent about 10 years in Arkansas trying to become like a literary writer, like Scott Fitzgerald or whoever, Hemingway, Nabokov. And so I wrote a couple of novels, which I thought were good at the time. And now I look back on it and think, you know, they were learning experiences. And I wrote dozens of short stories. And I wrote hundreds of poems. And I think I really was better at writing poems than anything. And when Billy and I decided to go to California to seek our fortunes, I just put aside poetry and I, you know, concentrated on screenplays. But I always had in the back of my mind that I would go back to poetry someday because I really love poetry. And I always sort of had it in my head that when I hit 70, I would start writing poems again. And that actually happened. When I hit 70, I wrote a couple of poems and really liked them. And then I was working on a novel one day, and it was in the morning, and I took a little pause from working. I walked up to the front window of the cup of coffee, just looked out at the street. And I couldn't see the street very well because there was like a tree and foliage and, you know, and then I saw across the street running down the sidewalk, I saw a young woman, and she was in jogging tights. She wasn't running from anyone, but it just suddenly flashed into my mind that what if she was the last woman on earth, and when she was being pursued by a pack of males? I thought, well, that's kind of neat. And then I stood there for 5 minutes or so, staring out, drinking the coffee, and the whole story of Baby Hawk really came to me. And I thought, wow, that would be a good something, a good novel, I guess. And no, I think I write this as a poem. And so the very next day I put aside my novel for what I thought would be a couple of days and started writing Baby Hawk. I thought it'd be 10 or 12 pages. And I got to page 10 or 12 and it was just like, okay, this is just getting started. So I just kept writing it. I ended up writing for 6 months on it. And it was, you know, like 150 pages long. And so it was like, wow, this is kind of like a book. So that's how it happened.
But now you say that later in your life, you're doing this. When you and Billy Bob Thornton went to Southern California, I mean, a lot of young people do that. They go to Southern California, go to Hollywood, seeking their fortune, and they're not successful. So right. What was the secret? How did you and Billy Bob Thornton have success in writing movie scripts together, for example?
Well, it's funny. We knew nothing about Hollywood. We knew nothing about screenwriting. We both loved movies. My literary writing career was going nowhere, you know, and I was kind of, you know, working, you know, some journalism jobs and, you know, teaching school a little bit and just kind of piecing things together the way people do. And Billy went to college, you know, only stayed about a year, dropped out, and he went to work for the highway department, but he was in a rock band and he was good. He was the drummer and the lead singer, and he was trying to make it, you know, in the music business. You know, I wanted to be Vladimir Nabokov, and he wanted to be Elvis Presley. It was really going nowhere for either of us. And when I started, when I was nearly 30, because 30 is a big, big point in anyone's life. You don't feel quite so young anymore.
Yeah.
I got the idea, why don't we just go to Hollywood and start writing screenplays and get into show business? And I broached the subject to Billy, who never really acted before. He was in a senior play in high school and enjoyed it. I'm sure he was good in it. But he just had this sort of natural charisma about him, which he still has. And he was a great storyteller, an oral storyteller. When he was always getting in these weird situations and strange adventures and meeting bizarre people. That's just Billy. I think Billy's still like that. And he'd tell me the story, and like he'd do all the voices of the characters that he met. So I told Billy, you know, you're a great storyteller, and you and I could write scripts together. And I really think you'd be a great actor. I told him he'd write me a John Travolta, although he really didn't. But John Travolta was big back then. So I worked on him for a long time, like a year. And we finally picked the date, June 7th, 1981, to leave. You know, we both gave up our lousy jobs, you know, said goodbye to our mothers, and, you know, headed west, and knew literally no one in Los Angeles. Had $500 between us when we left. By the time we got there, we had $400. So we went broke, and somehow we managed to stay out there just living at a very low level, I guess you could say. We would literally go hungry at times. So anyway, getting back to why Billy and I made it, I guess one thing I think we're both talented. I think we were both talented writers, and I think Billy was a talented actor. And I think part of it is we had nowhere else to go. I mean, we were really, you know, getting older, and our lives were going nowhere. My alternative would be to, because I got 2 degrees in English, would be to go back to get my doctorate and then in English, and just become an English professor the rest of my life and write novels in my spare time. And Billy's future would be continuing to work at the highway department and hope somehow his rock band broke out.
So when he got to California, that's what he was planning to do, because the two of you are running out of money pretty fast. So how did you take care of yourselves if you came here with no jobs? How did you feed yourself?
To make a long story short, Billy got a job at a Shakey's pizza parlor in Mar Vista. And I got a job at a private post office on Sunset Boulevard, 8033 Sunset, where I was like the mail guy. You know, mail would come in and I'd pick up the mail at the post office and sort it and put it in all the boxes. And so we just lived on a very, very low level. I mean, really, you know, virtually no money. I mean, I would go to the supermarket and I have like, you know, $5, and I would try to, you know, of course, $5 went further back then, but still it's not a lot. And then I would buy, you know, $5 worth of food to last me a week. So, but we were just stubborn, we were very, you know, we knew we were going to be successful. We just knew it. And when we came out here in June, we thought by Christmas we would have made it.
Well, that's inspiring.
It took years and years and years and years and years and years. A lot of stuff happened. All kinds of, you know, it was an adventure for two guys from a small town in Arkansas coming to Hollywood and trying to make it. And, you know, there was a lot of good and a lot of bad.
So when did you feel like you made it? Here you are starving. And you say, Billy Bob, you told him you could be a good actor. You knew you had literary skills. But when did your break come? Or how did it come?
Well, it didn't. There wasn't exactly one break. There were certain milestones. After 4 years, you know, we wrote a couple of scripts on our own, just as our calling cards. And, you know, they were, you know, pretty good. And we got lucky enough. We got an agent. And the way we got an agent was there was an actor named Don Blakely who had a box at the post office place I worked with, 344, I still remember it. And Don was a black guy. You know, he was a successful actor, not a star, but he worked all the time. He was studying the Actors Studio in New York. He was at a Shelley Winter's birthday party, and he ran into a young woman who just, you know, just gotten a job at a small company, Pierre Cosette's company. And we'd written a black-white buddy picture, and Don wanted to play the lead. And he was talking to Brooke, as her name was, in the kitchen. And somehow it came up, that script came up. She said, she's been looking for a black-and-white buddy picture. And so he said, well, I got one. So he gives her the script. She loves it. She tries to get her company to make it. They're not interested. And then just out of the goodness of her heart, she found out we didn't have an agent. She decided to get us an agent. And so she gave it to various people. And there was a company called the Susan Smith Company, a good medium level company, and an agent named Mary Cross. She signed us up. So that was our first break. 2 years later, we sold a script, the cop script, for, you know, about $25,000, which seemed like a fortune to us at the time. It allowed us to quit our jobs. And that was the last day job that I had. I was working as a temporary worker for the county of Los Angeles downtown. And so we were working writers in a way. And for about 4 years, it seemed like we would sell one script every year for not very much money, but it'd be just enough, you know, to get by. And then in 1990, we'd written a script called One False Move, which actually got made as a low budget movie with Bill Paxton and Billy was in it. And it became this, well, it looked like it was going straight to video. I mean, it was, you know, it hadn't gotten distribution. So it was just going to be one of those video movies. But it was at a couple of film festivals, and, you know, remember Siskel and Ebert, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Siskel and Ebert at separate film festivals. I think one was Santa Barbara Film Festival, and one was the Floating Film Festival, which is a film festival on a big ship. They saw One False Move. They both fell in love with it independently, and they decided it was their mission to get this movie distributed so everyone could see it. And then suddenly that happened, and it got great reviews. And Siskel and Ebert were always like on TV on The Tonight Show. Someone would tell me, oh, Siskel and Ebert were on TV again last night. And they actually mentioned you by name. You know, it was just really amazing. And that was in 1992. That was the big break for us. And then suddenly everyone was calling us, big directors, William Friedkin, Barbe Schroeder, others. Billy started getting acting jobs. That was the big break.
Well, let me remind us who, when you say we or us, this is Tom Epperson, and he was friends with Billy Bob Thornton. So when he say we, that's who he means, how he and his friend Billy Bob Thornton got their break in Los Angeles. After a break, author Tom Epperson and I will continue our conversation about his novel in verse, Baby Hawk. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Tom Epperson, whose book is a novel in verse, Baby Hawk. And I'm going to ask you to read the opening few lines in your book, Tom, so people will get an idea of what it sounds like.
Oh, okay. Here I go. There was only one left. She was barely 17. They shared her with each other and treated her as carefully as they could under the circumstances, because she was so rare and precious, more golden than gold, more sparkling than a diamond, the last female left on the earth, as far as they knew anyway. They called her Martha because she wouldn't tell them her real name. There were 16 of them. They did not want their group to devolve into chaos, so they had to make rules pertaining to Martha.
This is Tom Epperson reading from his novel in verse, Baby Hawk. And it raises so many questions, those first few lines. There was only one left. We wonder, one what left? And then you say she was barely 17. And then the they, and we don't know who she is or who they is at the opening. So we're very curious, what in the world is he talking about? And we don't know her name. They didn't know her name, so they just called her Martha. So when we're reading her story, sometimes she's referred to as the female or she or Martha. And we think, well, how does that relate to the title, Baby Hawk? So we have to turn a few pages into the story to find out, oh, what kind of hawk is this? So would you set up the scene where she and we found out that she's walking with her dad? And would you set up that scene for us when she and her dad are look up in the tops of the trees?
Sure. What's happened is there's been a worldwide plague that has killed almost everyone on Earth. And it was even worse for females than males. And so as far as the females, the female and her father know, she could be the last female on Earth. And they're living by themselves in the woods of California in the mountains. And, you know, they're reasonably happy. And then these bad guys come upon them and murder her father and take her prisoner. So this is kind of a flashback to where she remembers walking with her father.
And we now know the story of what inspired this. You were looking out your window, watching a jogger, and imagining, she's running. Maybe she's running from somebody.
Right. That's right.
So this, as you said, is a flashback because her dad was killed.
Right.
And that's sad part of the story.
Right. So I'll read a little bit.
Yeah.
About she and her dad. She looked up toward where the tops of the trees tossed in a gusty wind, reached in a yearning way toward the sky and sun. "They're so big," she said, "the trees." "Old growth," said her father. "Guess the loggers never got this far." She saw a movement near the base of a tree, went over to take a look. It was a bird. It was pretty big, but seemed a baby of some kind. It had brown feathers and pale yellow eyes that glared up at her. "Dad, come here." As her father approached, the bird backed up against the tree. He put his hands on his knees and studied it. "Looks like a baby goshawk." Suddenly, the baby hawk raised up and spread its wings, showing its white underside. Its curved beak hung half open. Its tiny talons gripped the earth. Its yellow eyes had a ferocious gleam as they looked up at her father and her. "It's okay," he said softly. "We're not going to hurt you." She smiled down at the baby hawk. So much defiance for such a little thing. Her father pointed up into the tree at a large twiggy mass. "There's the nest." "You think it fell out?" she said. He shrugged. "Maybe it's just been trying out its wings." "You think it's okay?" "Yeah, seems fine. And I'll bet Mom's nearby." They gazed down at the baby hawk. Its wings were still outstretched, its eyes still fixed on them. Her father seemed amused. "Looks like it's ready to kick our butts." And then they heard a high-pitched cry. "Kee, kee, 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 kee." They both looked up. "And there she is," her father said. A big gray hawk swooped down, passed 6 or 7 feet over their heads, wheeled around and headed back, all the while screaming, "Kee, kee, 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 kee." It came so low this time, they both ducked. Her father laughed. "Damn, Mom means business. We better get out of here." She looked again at the baby hawk and its yellow, wild, and yielding eyes. Then she and her father began to run. The mother hawk pursued them, harried them relentlessly through the trees, screaming, "Kee, kee, 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 kee." And then something changed. She seemed to be running more slowly, almost floating as if in a dream. She heard her father say her name. 3 times he said it, each softer than the last. A whisper of a whisper of a whisper. She stopped and looked around. Her father was gone. "Dad," she cried. She was wearing the red baseball cap he'd given her for her 11th birthday. The hawk dived down at her and shrieked and plucked it off her head and flew back toward the baby hawk with the cap dangling from its talons. Alone in the middle of the vast forest, she fell to her knees. She covered her face with her hands and began to weep. So the flashback was actually a dream of something that had happened.
And my guest is Tom Epperson, reading from his book, Baby Hawk, A Novel in Verse. And listeners have to be told this is in verse. It's me read it so nicely. One other thing that the listeners can't see, the cover. So would you describe the cover for them?
Wow. the covers, I think it's one of the best covers I've ever seen. I'm not saying it's just because it's my my book, but basically it shows the female from the back. Can't get a good look at her.
A human female now.
Yeah. She has long hair and she's in the forest. You can see trees around her. And then sort of hovering above her is the baby hawk. But the baby hawk looks huge. And the baby hawk, to me, almost looks like some sort of a savage god or something that she's standing in front of. So anyway.
His claws are outstretched.
Right. Yeah, so that's the cover.
Well, I want to go back to something that you read us about her. She was wearing the red baseball cap he'd given her for her 11th birthday. And those of us who live in California, you don't tell us then about this red baseball cap, but why would some of us maybe like that red baseball cap, Tom?
Well, because some of you might be San Francisco 49.
Yeah, we have.
We find out that when the plague happened, that the female and her father and her mother were living in San Francisco, and the father was actually a weatherman. And so he was a local weatherman that everyone knew.
and would recognize. And we don't know that in the beginning or even about this cap until you tell us later in the story.
That's right.
Now, there are some villains in this story that, oh, gosh, if you ever wanted to create villains that the reader would hate, I think you've done that, Tom. Oh, my gosh. Do you want to say anything about these villains that you've created?
Yeah, there's 16 of them at the beginning, although they suffer a certain amount of mortality as the book progresses. They're sort of... It's never said where they come from or their backgrounds, or I don't get backgrounds for anyone except the girl a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I think of them as like survivalist types that, you know, they're all white. I think of them as sort of white racist type, you know, the kind that are in the North. They're in different places, but they tend actually to be places like Idaho and, you know, just like rough, savage guys. Not well-educated mostly. But there are a couple of exceptions. I mean, not all of the 16 are bad. I mean, I don't want to give too much away.
But... No, in fact, that's why I haven't been asking about them. In fact, why don't we leave it at that and let the readers discover what goes on in the forest of Northern California.
Ooh, that sounds... All right.
So, my guest has been Tom Epperson. His latest novel, because he's written other books, his latest is a novel in verse, and the title is Baby Hawk. Thank you, Tom.
Oh, thank you, Nancy.
I would also like to thank my first guest, Paul Harris, whose book is Diary from the Dome, Reflections on Fear and Privilege During Katrina.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.